Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm your host, Bathsheba Monk, and tonight I am delighted to have as my guest Donald L. Miller, acclaimed author of 9 books, historian, PBS documentarian, as well as the John Henry McCracken Professor of History at Lafayette College. He's with us tonight to talk about his new book, which I think will change forever the way you see New York City. The name of the book is Supreme City, How Jazz Age Manhattan Gave Birth to Modern America. Welcome to the show, Donald.
Thank you, Bathsheba. I'm glad to be here.
Supreme City is a book that seeks to explain how the perfect storm of circumstances and personalities that was New York in the 1920s made modern America possible. How did you get interested in writing it?
Well, I had done a book on Chicago in the 19th century, and the grand plan was to do a tale of three cities, Chicago, New York, and L.A., at different points in the nation's history. And Chicago was, to me, the most characteristically industrial city: stockyards, steel mills, labor unions, big strikes. And New York, I thought, is the quintessential early 20th century city. When you move from an economy of production to one that's based on consumption and entertainment and spend and joy, things like that. And hopefully there'll be a third volume on Los Angeles, you know, and freeway culture and the movies and things like that later in the century. So I think every civilization, like the civilization of our own country, writes its biographies in the cities it creates. And I see New York as a kind of a window onto America, a way of understanding America, because so much of what came out of New York influenced the rest of the country.
At that time, it's so interesting to me how you pinpointed the 20s, though, and how all of these, you talk about the five circumstances that kind of came together to make Manhattan the perfect place: the Grand Central Terminal, New York skyline, jazz and the radio, mm-hmm. Spectator sports, and gangsters. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so... Why? I mean, could you explain to us, like why? Well, first of all, you start with the gangsters, and that was that was really interesting. And Jimmy Walker, he was like the best mayor I ever heard of. So, can you maybe talk about Jimmy Walker a little bit?
Yeah. Well, you know, what I try to do in the opening chapters is present a picture of the city, and you've got to understand its politics, and to understand its politics, you've got to understand crime, because crime is wrapped up into the political story, you know, very, very tightly. And Jimmy Walker is the mayor of New York from 1926 until, well, he was, you know, reelected, and he didn't serve out his second term. He was forced out of office in 1932. He's flashy. He's brilliant. He projects New York wonderfully. He's a showman. He wanted to be a songwriter and a vaudeville man, and he's brilliant on his feet as well. But there's some substance to the guy. He fought censorship, particularly book censorship. He defeated book censorship in the New York State Legislature with one funny line. He said, I know no woman who's been ruined by a book.
Right, right.
and that was Jimmy Walker, the quick quip. And even those who felt that he wasn't discharging his responsibilities, you know, in a conscientious way, he tended to slack off at times. He had a weak constitution. He didn't have a lot of moral courage to stand up to some of the Tammany bosses that were trying to push him around. And eventually, he is removed from office, and the reason being that he was taking a lot of money from very close friends. Now, it wasn't one of these situations where I give you, you know, $50,000 and you push forward my bridge project or my tunnel project. They could never nail him for that. If they had, he would have been in jail for a number of years. He was simply taking money to run a very high-level lifestyle. And Miami, Havana, Palm Springs, and things like that. He's probably in out of the city more than he's in it. And so with Franklin Roosevelt, moving from the governorship and ready to run for the presidency in 1932, the Democratic Party bosses felt that Walker and the investigation that they were launching in the Walker's lifestyle would be a hindrance to Roosevelt and might prevent his election. So he's pushed out of the scene. But he remained popular to New Yorkers as late as World War II, after the regime of Fidel LaGuardia, a tremendously popular mayor. They did a poll, and Jimmy Walker was voted the most popular mayor of the 20th century in New York. Well, he's an amazing character.
He did, you know, you pointed out that he did a lot of things of substance, like not just getting
rid of books. Yeah, I think a lot of the stories about Walker are based on, you know, he's all over the newsreels and he does a world tour, and so everybody associates Walker with New York, but and there's this feeling that he's more style than substance, but in working his papers at the Municipal Archives in New York and going deeply into his career, I found there's a lot of substance to Walker. He pushed the first. He thought Manhattan was growing so explosively that there had to be some sort of planning to control growth, limits on skyscraper development, for example, the height of buildings. And he pushed for and got through the New York's first city planning commission. But even more importantly, New York was dumping for well over a century, for 300 years, in fact, all of its garbage into the harbor. And it was a horrible stew of, you know, beaches were closed, things like that. And Walker is the first mayor to, you know, to address this issue, and institute New York's first, you know, efforts to clean up its harbor, the first sewage system. He built hospitals, he built schools, he fought hard for desegregation, he tried to bring in groups that Tammany tended to be a relentlessly Irish organization. He brought Italians and Jews into the organization, ethnically tolerant. He fought prohibition in New York, saw it as a violation, as I do, you know, of a person's, you know, basic rights, you know, and fundamentally a constitutional issue. And that made him immensely popular in the city, too. And they never really enforced prohibition in New York City. You know, there were more bars in New York at the end of Prohibition, or in the middle of Prohibition, wherever you want to go, than, you know, before Prohibition. And different kind of bars, nightclubs. Women had, you know, weren't allowed in the old stand-up Irish bars on the street corners in the neighborhoods.
And now we were allowed in.
Now you're allowed in, right. And you know, and it's a mix. It's a strange kind of a smorgasbord there. There's gangsters. Like today, there's gangsters, there's athletes. Athletes are immensely popular in the period. There's the Vanderbilts and the Astors, and there's the Thai salesman from Paducah, you know. I mean, everybody's there. It's a kind of a Texas Guinan, one of my characters who ran a succession of really popular nightclubs in the city. She was the hostess, if you will. And she said, if you want to see real democracy, come to my clubs. He said, it's right here, sexual class and everything else.
So the upper classes really wanted to mix it up a little bit with the...
There's some kind of allure, too, with you know, sitting shoulder to shoulder with a prominent gangster. Mm-hmm. And the most prominent gangster in New York in the period comes out of Hell's Kitchen, which is, of course, on the west side of New York. And West Side Story, of course, is filmed there. And or about, you know, Hell's Kitchen. They now call it Clinton. They've kind of gentrified the area.
Oh, I see.
But, he comes out of there, and he's a stone-cold killer before World War One. He kills three or four guys. He finally gets, you know, sent to prison for a guy he didn't kill. But as he said, that was justice. You know, I killed three guys. I deserve what I got.
Caught up with them, right.
He gets out, and there's an opportunity staring him right in the face. He's an immigrant, an Irish immigrant, brought up in the slums of Manchester, actually, where his parents had migrated and into the United States with his mother, and grew up in Hell's Kitchen, real rough neighborhood, made friends with George Raft, the actor who played him in innumerable Hollywood movies. And his girlfriend was Mae West, of course, sexy Mae West, and she's also from Hell's Kitchen. And he's the guy who sees the opportunity that the federal government really gifts, you know, the gangsters, these street punks, many of them, an enormous industry, the eighth largest industry in the country, the brewing industry. And Oney hooks up with Frank Costello. Later, he's an Italian from Calabria, Italian immigrant from Calabria, and later prime minister of the underworld, the leader of the mafia. And a guy named Bill Dwyer, who runs a big popular sports saloon on Broadway. And he's a big man on the big stem, as they call it, Broadway. And the three of them form a bootlegging combination that brings in liquor by sea. If you're up in Chicago, you usually brought it in by land or over the lake. But in New York, you know, a city of the sea, you bring it in. And he pays off the Coast Guard, the Long Island police, the New York police, and the police in his neighborhood where he built a fortress-like brewery. Can you imagine that right in the middle of Prohibition, you know?
Right,
You know, the aroma of the hops is all over the streets. The windows are open in the summertime. And there's federal prohibition agents wanting desperately to close it down. They've got this thing in their sights. And what would happen is they'd go out in the street, walk around the bar, prepare for a raid, and the New York cops would pick them up for loitering. And cops, of course, were paid off by Madden. But Madden, unlike the Chicago mobsters like Capone and Frank Nitti, he puts away his gun, and I'm sure there's some violence. But he wants to try to stay, you know, away from, you know, this, you know, you see so many movies with Tommy guns in them about, you know, the gang fights, the street fights in New York and Chicago. Well, there wasn't much of that when Oney was ruling Midtown Manhattan, and so he kept a lid on that sort of stuff. Owned a succession of nightclubs. Hey, if you make beer, Madden's number one, it was called, a creamy lager. You got to have an outlet, so he controls the outlet. He hooks up with Texas Guinan. That's what happens in the book. There's all these connections.
I know. That's people. What I picked up.
There's
yeah.
All these connections. I really tried to. It was great when I'd find them. I go, yeah. You know, I mean, everything seems, you know.
It all
you
fit
know.
Together, like the
yeah,
cops
exactly.
and the robbers.
Exactly. Dante, right. I remember, I quote this to my students. He said, hell's a place where nothing connects. We're here. Everything seems to connect. I mean, he owns the Cotton Club in Harlem. It's one of the first bars he buys. He buys it from an African-American prizefighter, Jack Johnson, and a very famous guy. And Johnson was broke at the time in 1923. And Oney hires one of the best stage producers in New York City, who later worked for the famous Ziegfeld. And they fix up the Cotton Club, a kind of a tropical kind of environment. Of course, it was a club that was rigidly segregated. There were black entertainers and an all-white audience. But there in comes Duke Ellington in 1927, and Oney hopes to engineer that deal. They had lost their band leader right before the Christmas season, and Ellington was touring, and they got a guy to go over to Philadelphia, and they talked to the impresario who was running the show, and they said, hey, you know, we want Ellington. And he said, no, I've got a contract with Ellington. And they said, you got to be big or you're going to be dead. He said, I'll be big. So he released Ellington, and he starts playing at the club. Bill Paley, who founded CBS, the great rival of NBC, these are the two brand new and the first in the world radio networks, founded within a year of each other, 1926 and 27. And Paley puts he and his wife loved Ellington's music, and the Cotton Club, the gathering place for people like Walker and Guinan would go up there. And he puts them on the radio. So Duke Ellington's music, the music of New York, the music of his people, as he said, those are his words, went out to the country. And with his records, you know, I mean, they helped to propagate jazz.
So,
you know?
So can we say that prohibition actually helped jazz?
Oh, it did. There's no question about it. Yeah. Absolutely no question about it. With the clubs, the records, the whole zip that was in the life at the time. Absolutely.
Oh, great. Well, we have to take a little break here. This is Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm Bathsheba Monk.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. For more information, visit WDIY.org.
Hello, welcome back to Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm talking to Donald Miller, about the author of the new book, Supreme City, How Jazz Age Manhattan Gave Birth to Modern America. Donald, as you point out in your book, one of the big things about New York at this time was the building boom. So what were the big projects that were going on there that sort of connected New York to...
Well, it's the biggest building boom of its time, and maybe one of the biggest building booms in the history of cities. And it begins in 1913 with Grand Central Terminal. They had a Grand Central Station long before this, but they modernized the station. They synced the tracks. The area... Of course, the station's where it is today on 42nd Street, but the area north of 42nd Street today is beautiful, arrow straight, you know, Park Avenue, one of the most regal streets in the world. But it wasn't there in 1913. So the railroad sinks its tracks, and then before there's this fan-like railroad yard there full of smoke and soot and, you know, roaring trains. And the grid didn't even go there. There was no cross streets in New York at that time, you know, just above the station. So they electrify the trains, they sink them, and on the roof of the station, the Grand Central Company goes into the real estate business, and they build modern Park Avenue all the way up to 59th Street, and they called it Terminal City, and there it sits still today. And a lot of it looks exactly like it looks today. And over on Fifth Avenue, there's this enormous construction change there where the whole avenue from 42nd Street to the park was lined with Vanderbilt mansions, each of them about a block long. And they tore down these urban castles. Young Jewish real estate agents up from the ghetto get in there and saw the commercial possibilities of Fifth Avenue. They tear them down. They buy them from the widows of the Vanderbilts and the Astors. And they build stores like Saks Fifth Avenue and Bergdorf Goodman. So, and lots of the widows of the who are, you know, trying to keep up these mansions move over to penthouses, which are a brand new thing, which are built on Park Avenue. So they're, in the 20s, they were called mansions in the sky. And people had never lived that high before. So all of Midtown, in other words, New York for 300 years, Lower Manhattan ruled New York, and all of a sudden, suddenly and spectacularly, Midtown becomes the king. There are no skyscrapers above 42nd Street before World War I, and by the end of the 20s, half of New York's skyscrapers are there, and they're putting up a building, not a skyscraper, but a building every 57 minutes. So I go into this construction boom, and of course it culminates in this wonderful symbolic building, the Chrysler Tower, built by Walter Chrysler.
Of course, right.
Yeah, and I try to get behind the buildings into the people who built them. And that's what this book's about, people.
It seems like you're talking about the city, but it's really this great list and biographies of these characters.
Yeah, each chapter, it stands on its own. You could put it on your nightstand and read each chapter as an independent thing. And in the book itself, it's a long book, but it's divided into five parts. And I love it when reviewers say it reads like a novel.
Oh, it does read like a novel.
I try to write it like that. And then when you get the buildings built by these wonderfully self-made characters, Irwin Chanin, who built the building that still stands in front of Grand Central Terminal and the tallest in building in New York, he called it, the lobby is dedicated to the theme of City of Opportunity. Well, that's Irwin Chanin. He's broke in 1918. He's a veteran of World War I. 10 years later, he's one of the great real estate kings of New York, and he's throwing up this magnificent tower.
Well, that's
there's so many stories like that in the book.
I have a question. How did they get their money to do this?
Well, he did it slowly. I mean, you know, Channon had no money. He had no prospects. And he and his brother decided to build a couple of track houses, little cottages, and to Jewish immigrants who were moving out of the East Side, Lower East Side, over to Bensonhurst in Brooklyn. And it takes off, one building after another, and then a six-story, then a 12-story. Then he moves into Manhattan, crosses the bridge. Wow, that's a big move. And then he begins to buy theaters. He buys a hotel because he can't find a hotel to stay in that night. He buys theaters because he wanted theaters that were democratically set up, where you didn't have to, where the hoi polloi used to have to come in and sit in the balcony and in the cheap seats, as it were. And there were no cheap seats anymore. There was one entrance, one fee, one admissions fee for everybody. And then he becomes a real estate giant. He says, you know, I belong on 42nd Street. And there it is, 42nd Street. Again, no skyscrapers. And all of a sudden, it's by the end of the 20s, they're calling it the Valley of Giants, you know, the Daily News building built by Joseph Patterson, who founds the Daily News, the first American tabloid, and he launches that on a shoestring.
Yeah, oh, that's that's an interesting story about the Daily News.
It is.
News.
I mean, he the way he covers sports, for example, he tells one of his young sports writers, he said, cover Babe Ruth. They just built Yankee Stadium in 1923. Cover Ruth. He's a phenomenon, but I don't want you to cover him just during the baseball season. Cover him year-round. And it's the beginning of athletes as national celebrities, and people are interested almost as much, if not more, in what they're doing off the field as on the field. So this reporter, Marshall Hunt, covers Ruth year-round, and I describe that. And then a guy comes in from California with no money, and he's a sports agent. He invented the term, and he sells himself to Ruth, and he ghostwrites, has, you know, writers like Damon Runyon, and things ghostwriting stories for Ruth and other baseball players. So all of a sudden, kids are reading about them, and there's baseball cards and things like that. So New York's baseball heroes become the heroes of the country. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's the beginning in the 20s of what we know today as mass spectator sports. I mean, you could get 3,000-4,000 people at a prize fight in 1912. Now they have to, they can't even find a place big enough to stage the Dempsey-Tunney fight, the famous Dempsey-Tunney fight.
Oh, really?
1927. Mm-hmm. They have to go to Chicago, to Soldier Field, 110,000 people. And
so were these broadcasts on the radio too then? Was that?
Yeah, they were on the radio. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And during the Dempsey-Tunney fight, where Dempsey apparently knocked Tunney out, but it was a famous long count when the referee didn't continue the count because Dempsey didn't go to his corner. He stood over him like almost a savage, and he's going to punch him to death when he got off the canvas. He didn't go to his corner. They stopped the count, and Tunney was down for 14 seconds. But the announcer kept screaming, Graham McNamee kept screaming on NBC radio, "Tunney's down, Tunney's down." And reportedly, who knows, but reportedly a dozen people across the country had heart attacks during the fight.
Oh, really?
On the radio. I don't know how you verify that, but it's in the New York Times. It must be true.
It must be true then. Okay. So they started the Daily News. That was like the first tabloid.
The first tabloid, yeah. Oh. And by 1925, it's the biggest selling paper in New York. And by 1927, it's the biggest selling newspaper in the world. And it's photojournalism. And there's sex, sensationalism, crime. But they actually hired some excellent reporters, paid them well, and particularly emphasized the sports page. This is an age when sports writers like, you know, Greene Lardner and Damon Runyon and people like that are paid as much, if not more, as, you know, your Paris correspondent for the paper. People just ate up sports in the 20s. So some of the book is dedicated to that. And
yeah,
dedicated
as well
to these big building projects. I was really interested in things that, to me, were mundane, like going through the Holland Tunnel. And I'd see these giant structures when I go in and out of the tunnel, these two skyscraper-like buildings, one sitting in the river and one sitting outside it, one, two on each side of the river. What are these things? And I found out Clifford Holland is actually a Clifford Holland, a Holland behind the building, just like there's a Chrysler behind the Chrysler building. He built the ventilation system because it's a first vehicular tunnel, first tunnel for cars and trucks. So if you don't ventilate it, you know, it's a gas chamber, and people die in it. So what he did, and you can't just blow air in there. That's what a lot of engineers said. Gigantic fans blow the air through there, because if you had a fire, it would create a cyclone, and a cyclone of fire. And what he did, these wind factories are built in the river. That's what he called it. And they open the sides of them, open like Venetian blinds. They have no windows. And the air comes in. There's turbines that move it. And then the air is moved into the bottom of the tunnel. Out it comes at hubcap level, still today. And then the bad air sucked out of the top of the tunnel. So it's a breathing machine. So when you go in the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, every Midtown Tunnel, every tunnel in New York is organized like this today, every tunnel in the world. And tragically, Clifford Holland overworks himself and has a nervous breakdown and a heart attack and dies at a very early age while they're building the tunnel.
But in the meantime, he's connecting New Jersey to Manhattan.
He's connecting New Jersey to Manhattan. And here's this great symmetry we were talking about. These things kept happening. I said, I can't believe they're happening one on top of the other, and they're connected, because they open the tunnel, and weeks later, they lay the foundations for the first New York Bridge across the harbor, the one-mile-long, you know, George Washington Bridge across the Hudson River that connects New York to Bergen County and to, you know, highways that are going across the country at that time, the Lincoln Highway and things. And so,
and then all these cool people were coming in then.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, of my characters, I have a cast of characters that I list at the beginning of the book. There's over 30 of them. It's like a playbill there. I have these characters.
It is. It's like a script.
It was my student's idea, Sean Grimm. It was my student's idea. And it was a great idea. And so I said, well, why don't we do a cast of characters? And he laid the whole thing out. But almost all of them are from outside New York. And then halfway through the book, I went back to an old standard. E.B. White wrote a wonderful book about New York City, and I think it was in 1947, you know, less than 100 pages, but he captures it beautifully. And he says that there are three types of New Yorkers, you know, the commuters, those who are born and grew up in New York, and the outsiders who come in to stay. And he said these outsiders are the ones that really give it its zip. its spirit, its character.
Do you think that that's like how it's usually done, you know, that you have to come from the outside to really see a place?
I think, yeah, to see it fresh.
The opportunities.
To get pulled. And you know, you've got to uproot yourself. It's just like an immigrant. Everyone thinks, oh, immigrants, you know, they're solid people, solid, you know, salt of the earth and stuff, but very conservative. But look, any immigrant that came to New York or anywhere else in the 1920s, whether from the Minsk, like David Sarnoff, from this backward medieval village, they have to make gutsy decisions to pull up, give up everything, carry everything they have.
And then they have nothing to lose.
And come here, and they have nothing to lose. And they're drawn to New York. Some people make it. Some people don't. Jack Dempsey came in the first time and didn't, and he said, you know, I found out it's New York doesn't want you. You want New York, and you got to really impress yourself on the city. But these people came in, unlike a lot of Russian tycoons today who come in and buy skyscrapers on Park Avenue. They're building these 80- and 90-story buildings there, but they're just there to park their money. My characters are there to plant their flag and change the city and change themselves.
And they did.
And they did.
And they did.
They really did.
So this sounds like a great movie. Is there any hope for that?
Well, you know, people are looking at it right now. You know, that usually takes some time. And, you know, I've had some feelers already.
Oh, good. You have something else in the works right now, a documentary with Tom Hanks and
Steven Spielberg,
right. So on one of your other books, one of your other works?
Yeah, Masters of the Air is the last book I wrote, and it's a book about this tremendous bomber campaign that the United States launched along with the British from England in World War II. That was one of the decisive factors in the war. And it's a book about fear and courage and love, and London's part of the story, and, you know, an airman could be over Berlin bombing it at 12 o'clock and back in London with a girl of his dreams at midnight. And
convenient.
It's a different kind of war than the ground war, but Spielberg and Hanks have bought the book, and we're making a movie right now, a 10-part HBO series called Masters of the Air, a follow-up to Band of Brothers in the Pacific, which were both 10-part HBO series.
Oh, great.
Well, this we're in the writing stage right now, and we're coming to the end of that, and we'll then move into production.
Oh, great. Okay, so we're looking forward to that. I'd like to see New York. I'd like to see Supreme City come to the screen and
be fun.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And so, where can everybody buy Supreme City?
Anywhere.
The usual places.
Local Barnes and Noble stores, Moravian bookstore,
online.
Your local college bookstore, online. The audiobook is out already.
Oh, great. Okay.
The ebook is out already.
Okay.
So it's rare that a publisher publishes those three things simultaneously. Okay. And, you know, for those who want to wait, the paperback will be out in the spring. I shouldn't say that.
Don't say that. Okay, Donald. Okay. So listen, we really thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Lehigh Valley Art Salon. Donald Miller is the author of Supreme City, How Jazz Age Manhattan Gave Birth to Modern America. This is Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I'm Bathsheba Monk.